that 2 gigawatt of hydropower, that fleet, much of it was built, you know, over 50, 60 years ago, and it's been working hard. Yeah, I call it the workhorse of renewables, because it's been powering decade after decade for it's basically seen the rise and fall of coal, nuclear, and now gas, and it's still generating there in the background. So these assets have real longevity. It's not going to want to cycle the way a battery does. So it's going to be operationally very different to batteries, and it needs to be operationally different because it's a turbine. I think that's the difference. We have to look at how they're going to operate and how they're going to operate differently and how they're going to get their revenue streams. We need a lot of storage. So I think there's room for everything, but we definitely need to see pumped storage hydro coming online. These are big assets, they're big infrastructure assets. They need that support in terms of the cap and floor mechanism. But once they're on the system, they're good for many, many years, which is what we need. We need resilience, mm-hmm. and we need certainty, and we need to have confidence.
Renewable and reliable, hydropower offers a high capacity, long duration storage solution. In this episode, Kate Gilmartin, Chief Executive of the British Hydropower Association, joins Ed to discuss the different types of hydropower and the role of this technology in long-duration energy storage. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode, and give us a rating wherever you listen. Let's jump in.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today I am joined by Kate. Kate, welcome to the Modo podcast.
Thank you very much, Ed. Good to be here.
And let's kick off, as always, by just getting a bit of background in terms of who you are and kind of what's your field of expertise.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ed. I'm Kate Gilmartin. I'm Chief Exec at the British Hydropower Association. And my background, I did an undergrad degree in fuel and energy and then a master's in renewable energy. And I've been working in the renewable energy space for a number of years now, across many technologies and also across community energy. I'm a founder member of Community Energy England as well.
Okay, amazing. And let's just talk a little bit about BHA, so the British Hydropower Association. What exactly do they do?
Well, we represent hydropower industry across the UK. We're a membership association, and we are there to promote and enable hydropower and really to try and make it relevant within the government's commitment to decarbonising the grid by 2030.
Okay, superb. Hydropower, that encompasses a few things, right? So what falls within hydropower?
Well, we obviously have hydropower, which is run of river. We also have hydropower that's conventional or reservoir hydro. We also represent pump storage hydro, which is two reservoirs, upper and lower, and you push water down and generate, and then you pump up water to the upper reservoir. And we also have tidal range, which is either a lagoon or a barrage, and is essentially low head hydropower.
Okay, and those, let's just talk through kind of how those work. So I think the one that people might think about first is pumped hydropower, as you say, effectively two sources of water. Like how does that work? What does it typically do?
Well, another word for it is a water battery. So essentially, we've got four existing pumped storage hydro plants in the UK, all now built over 50 years ago. And they were there to really balance out coal and nuclear. So the idea is that you have a base load from coal or power. And obviously, during the day, we have a higher demand. And then during the night, we'd use that cheaper electricity to pump water up into the upper reservoir. And then during those peak tea time demands, you can then generate by releasing the water from the upper reservoir down into the lower reservoir. So it's essentially a water battery.
Okay. And then as time has gone on, so obviously we've then started to add more renewables to the system. It's not become such a straightforward kind of coal and gas running to meet demand. We're now starting to add in kind of intermittent generation. The role of that sort of pumped hydro has changed a little bit as we've kind of got into a more net zero style system. And so maybe that kind of conventional kind of charging overnight and then discharging into peak generation has changed a bit.
Yes, definitely. And if you speak to the operators of pumped storage hydro, they'll tell you that, you know, comparative to 40 years ago, they cycle a lot more often now because they are there to pick up those peak demands and also to pump when we've got surplus generation. So their operational pattern has changed considerably. Now we have more variable renewables on the system.
I suppose I don't really think about pumped hydro as cycling just because the depth, the duration of some of those sites is so much longer than, say, a standard kind of battery site, which is maybe what we might talk about more on this particular podcast. So what is the kind of typical duration of those existing four sites?
In terms of total capacity, they've got 26 gigawatt hours of storage. As you know, we have got the cap and floor coming along, and we've got a pipeline of at least 11 projects that are wanting to come forward through that cap and floor mechanism. So considering currently we've got 2.8 gigawatts with 26 gigawatt hours storage, but actually in the pipeline there's nearly 10 gigawatts with about 200 gigawatt hours of storage. So we're really kind of increasing that storage capacity.
Okay, so I'm kind of like trying to have to do some quick math. So just under 10 hours for the current fleet, but 20 hours is kind of what the future fleet looks like.
Each site is different. Each site has a different amount of capacity and storage. So some are up to 36 hours of generation, and others are smaller at 6 hours of storage.
Mm-hmm. It feels like, why can't it just be longer? Like, it's just a lake, right, at the top of a hill. Well, why couldn't it be sort of double that? What stops it from being 50 hours or 100 hours?
Well, it depends how you want to run your plant. But if you're going at full capacity and it's a 1.5 gigawatt scheme, for example, but you could run that at a third capacity and then you'd have three times as much storage. Mm-hmm. But really, it's about the capacity of the reservoir and how you want to operate your plant.
Okay, so that's pumped hydro. Then on to just sort of regular hydro. So you refer to it as run-of-river hydro. How does that work? Is that dispatchable in the same way that pumped hydro is?
Well, we have three different types of hydropower. So low-head hydropower, which is run-of-river and is unlikely to have storage. We have high-head hydropower, which in some cases will also have storage, so reservoir as well. And then conventional hydropower, which is essentially reservoir hydropower. So each does something a little bit different. But I think what we really overlook is that within conventional hydropower, so that reservoir hydropower, we've got about 900 gigawatt hours of storage, which is a huge amount when you think of the current pump storage hydro capacity of 26 gigawatt hours. And really that storage has just been operating decade after decade, doing the morning peak and the tea time peak. And actually what we're saying to government is that hydropower could be used quite differently if it was to become smart, flexible through digitisation, for example. And actually we could be using that to complement the variable renewables on the grid much better in the future. So we're really kind of pushing government to think hard about how we look at existing hydropower fleet and how we want it to work for us harder in the future.
Okay, and just so we've talked about the pumped hydro fleet, the four particular assets. The other hydropower you're talking about, what do those assets look like?
So we've got a total fleet capacity of 2 gigawatt. We think there's another gigawatt out there. Birmingham University did a piece of work for us a couple of years ago to say that actually there's another gigawatt. And people always get a bit fixated with total installed capacity. And I think it's worth reminding everyone that actually total installed capacity doesn't tell us when it's generating and it doesn't give us a capacity factor. So I always kind of push back on government and say, well, it's 2 gigawatt, but comparative to solar, that's actually kind of more like 8 gigawatt in terms of actual generation. But it's generation that happens across winter at peak tea time demand when we really need it. So for me, it's all about the gigawatt hours and the generation profile rather mm-hmm. than the installed capacity. Mm-hmm. But that 2 gigawatt of hydropower, that fleet, much of it was built, you know, over 50, 60 years ago. And it's been working hard, you know, that kind of, yeah, I call it the workhorse of renewables, because it's been powering decade after decade for it's you know, it's basically seen the rise and fall of coal, nuclear and now gas, and it's still generating there in the background. So these assets have real longevity. Mm-hmm. And a real value for just not just our generation and previous generations, but future generations as well.
So if someone wanted to see a hydropower site, where would they go? What does it look like?
Well, 80% of hydropower is in Scotland. And unfortunately for us as an industry, hydropower isn't particularly visible. So, you know, you might be on a nice walk and you'd go past something that a kiosk that you might think is a substation, and actually it will be a powerhouse. So unless it's a low head hydropower, like an Archimedes screw, it's usually hidden away, which is great because it's not visible. And that means that we can have hydropower in national parks and in World Heritage sites. But actually, in terms of the general public and our policymakers and our politicians, they don't see it. It's not very visible. But you might go to Scotland and see a really big reservoir. And again, you probably wouldn't. You might notice a penstock, and maybe you might notice the powerhouse at the bottom of that penstock. But you might just walk past that and not know that there's hydropower generating away in the background there.
Okay, what's a penstock?
Oh, sorry, that's a pipeline.
Okay.
That takes the water from the top to top of the intake to the powerhouse.
Okay, and then so we've done pumped hydro, we've done hydropower, and then the last one is kind of the low head hydropower, which is, as you said, like the Archimedes screw in a river type situation.
Yes.
Okay, And then one thing you just talked about earlier was around the capacity. So we talked about a few of the capacities of these assets, and then you mentioned the capacity factor. What is that capacity? Like, what is a capacity factor for hydro? Why is it important?
Well, it depends what type of scheme it is, but hydropower can have quite a high capacity factor, which means that it's generating for many of the hours over the year. So, for example, Kinlochleven, which is a really big reservoir hydro scheme up in Scotland that was built in 1919, it has a 95% capacity factor. So it's generating for 95% of the year. Okay. So that's really useful to have. It's kind of like base load, really.
Yeah, and that's obviously critical, right? When you have these periods where low solar, low wind, we need things to generate. Yeah. Things that have that kind of high capacity factor are really critical in those winter periods.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the other point is that often hydropower is in rural areas and it might be embedded generation, so it's connected at the distribution network. And what I keep saying to government is, if you want to electrify heat and get people off oil in rural areas where actually they're at the end of the grid and the weak rural grid at that, you know, we need to have generation, new generation. Those electrons need to be generated to match the electrification heat and that kind of flexible load that's going to be going on the grid as well. So really thinking about hydropower in terms of local energy solutions as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, super interesting. It's just hit me for a moment. 1919, you mentioned. How is that site still running? Is it kind of in its original format, or is it just a totally new site that was kind of nameplate 1919 but is now totally different?
So we have a lot of hydropower that has been operating for, you know, 100 years. And if hydro is well maintained, there's no reason why it can't continue to generate. That particular site did get refurbished, I think, in 2008. So it has got some new Jilks turbines in there. But there are many sites around the world that are generating after 100 years of operation. But you have to, you know, you have to maintain those sites. But I think the history of hydropower is really interesting. A lot of our hydropower fleet was actually developed under the North of Scotland Hydroelectricity Board in the 1950s. And that was done under a social mandate to actually take the grid to the North of Scotland, because it was deemed to be important for people to actually have electricity and improve their lives. And I think we've forgotten about that in some ways in today's world, that actually electricity should be there for a social good. And, you know, we should try and get it to be affordable to enable people to have healthy, warm homes as well. So I like the fact that a lot of that hydropower was developed under that social mandate, and it's still there now generating for us. And actually, that fleet of hydropower in the energy crisis of 2022, it actually saved us consumers $1.1 billion on our bills. That's another piece of research that we've undertaken just to show that these assets have value well after the Treasury discount rate.
You will certainly have fans of storage listening to this, so they will always appreciate a stat as well. So that's really good. And then maybe I just wanted to get into, so we've just talked about the sort of hydropower, how hydropower generates low head, and also then the pumped hydro. In terms of other things that, say, pumped hydro can provide, people often talk about spin gen. What's spin gen?
Well, essentially, I mean, I'd say as well with pumped storage hydro, you know, it's proven, it's reliable. As I just said, it has longevity. You know, these schemes go on and on. And the point you just made is it's inertia. You know, these are solid lumps of metal that spin. And actually, that's really useful on the grid to have that inertia. So, yeah, there's lots of facets of pumped storage hydro that actually help grid stability and grid operability. And that's really important in terms of our UK grid resilience as well.
Okay, so this is kind of the concept that if we need inertia on the system, but we don't necessarily need generation, we could call on pumped hydro to spin the turbines, spin the mass of those turbines, and that will provide inertia to the system, giving system stability.
Yes, yeah. And I think the other point as well is the size of pumped storage hydro. You know, some of the schemes in the pipeline are 1.8 gigawatts. So this is a huge, you know, huge amount of power. And inertia that can be turned on very, very quickly as well. So I think that's really important to remember, the scale of these schemes, as well as their longevity and the fact they're proven and reliable.
So lots of positives on the pumped hydro side, but maybe coming on to some of the challenges, right? So I think you mentioned the last project was built in 1980s, which was Dunorwig. But since then, we haven't had another pumped hydro system coming online. What are the challenges that face pumped hydro, and why have we not had systems come online?
Well, I think we have to remember that when the last pumped storage hydro plants were built, they were done so under state ownership. So they were state funded, they were state organised, as was a lot of our energy system as well. So these are, you know, high capital cost, and also there is, you know, they're big and they're infrastructure projects. And we probably could have done with them 20 years ago as we started to look more at intermittent renewables coming online, but we are where we are. And actually, you know, government recognise now that we need more flexibility in the system as we get more and more renewables on the system as well. So in terms of the barriers, the main barrier has been the price stabilisation mechanism that actually allows investors to have a secure rate of return, which is obviously part of the cap and floor mechanism that's coming through at the moment. And that enables investors to actually put the money in and actually we can deploy those assets.
Okay, and maybe let's talk about let's just wrap up one last thing on the investment side. So if I'm building a pumped hydro site, and apologies to the hydropower and Run of River Hydro here, but how long does that take?
Well, I mean, SSE started Coire Glas actually, I think it was 15 years ago, looking at it, that is. But in terms of how long they actually take, you know, there are developers now working on schemes that they think they can build within 5 years. Okay. So it depends on the planning process. It depends on having the price stabilisation mechanism there, which means you can mobilise investment. And obviously not just investment in terms of CapEx, but also in terms of DevEx as well. So that development finance, you have to have a route to market for people to actually put the funding in to get projects through DCO. So so we've got those projects coming through now, which is really exciting. But we had to get the cap and floor in place or agreed by government for that mobilisation to really happen.
We'll definitely come to cap and floor in a second. Just DCO, what does that mean?
Sorry, the development consent order.
And why is that important for pumped hydro?
It's planning. It's anything for planning permission over 100 megawatts needs to go through the DCO process.
Okay, superb. Cap and floor, let's do it. Right, so what is the cap and floor?
So it's probably best to think about the interconnectors. So we've got interconnectors and they have been brought forward by a price stabilisation mechanism, which is called the cap and floor. And that essentially means that if the rates of return drop below a certain threshold, then the consumer will pay the developer. But if the profits go a certain cap, then the developer will pay us as the consumer. And this has worked really well for interconnectors. And we're looking to see whether many of those similarities, well, there'll be many similarities between the interconnector cap and floor and pumped storage hydro cap and floor, although the cap and floor for pumped storage hydro will be more complex because they are much riskier projects and they are more complex in their development.
Okay, and so just kind of a couple of questions around cap and floor. How long does that last for?
We're expecting it to be a 25-year contract, just like the cap and floor for interconnectors.
Okay, and how do you kind of how are you eligible for it?
Well, there are certain things that government have yet to decide on, including the eligibility criteria. However, at the moment, it looks like there'll be two streams. So stream one will be for projects over 100 megawatts with capacity for 6 hours. And then and TRL, so technology readiness level of 9, which means that they are proven and reliable. So that's where we think pumped storage hydro is going to be sitting. There's also stream two, which is up to 50 megawatts. And again, 6 hours of duration in terms of storage, and that can be projects that are less, they're not proven and reliable as yet, they've got a lower technology readiness level.
Mm-hmm. and in that lower the stream two with the lower TRLs, what are there hydropower techs in there?
Well, yeah, we have got one of our members, Re-Energize, and they have a high density fluid closed loop pumped storage hydro project. So they've got a pilot project going on in Plymouth at the moment, which is, I think that's 5 megawatts at the moment. And that's through the load pilot innovation project. So, you know, they're looking at whether they can be eligible for that stream two.
Okay.
And other projects like Liquid Air, there's one in Carrington, again, which has come through the load pilot innovation fund. So again, they might be in that stream two.
Okay. And then back to stream one, which I think is broadly the biggest stuff. I think there's kind of, this is a podcast that talks about all things energy transition, but also kind of covers batteries. I'm really interested to get your take on, from a consumer perspective, like what's the right mix of pumped hydro versus battery?
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, at the moment, there aren't many battery facilities that are doing 6 hours, although...
There are none.
There are none in the UK, but there are some globally. So there is a consideration of whether this will open the door for batteries to come in and say, well, actually, we could do 6 hours now if we stack them, et cetera, et cetera. I think the key for me, I mean, as I said, you know, my background is across all technologies, renewable energy, but also just, you know, how do we decarbonize as fast as we can? That's going to give us resilience across the system, but it's also going to give value to consumers. And I just go back to the point that, you know, pumped storage hydro, it's proven, it's reliable, and it has longevity. It's going to be there for a really, really long time. And that gives value to consumers over a really long period of time. I think the other point as well is that there's going to be different revenue stacks across long duration energy storage, but pumped storage hydro will have a different revenue stack to battery storage. And we don't know exactly how the system's going to operate in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. And what we can say is we are more likely to understand the revenue stack and the operation of pumped storage hydro than we are in battery storage. So I think, in terms of NESO, I would be very comfortable with having a good mix, but I'd really want to see pumped storage hydro in the mix because, again, it's you know, they're used to working with pumped storage hydro. It's that phone call to say, fire it up.
Yeah, okay. But just to come kind of, just to talk a little bit about that sort of charging and discharging of storage, right? So batteries and pumped hydro can both do that. I suppose the thing you're calling out is that one is kind of an electrochemical system with an inverter, whereas that's the battery storage, and the other one is the pumped hydro, which is effectively what we've just been describing. So water running down a hill, turning a physical turbine, which provides inertia. And so when you talk about the revenue stack being slightly different, is that what you mean? That there's kind of other elements of pumped hydro that you don't get with a storage system?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose my point is that batteries can do fast frequency response, etc. And although pumped storage hydro can, you know, generate within a minute or two, it's not going to want to cycle the way a battery does. So it's going to be operationally very different to batteries, and it needs to be operationally different because it's a turbine, and you know the owners of that plant will want to use it in a certain way. So I think that's the difference. We have to look at how they're going to operate and how they're going to operate differently and how they're going to get their revenue streams. And I think we need a lot of storage. So I think there's room for everything, but we definitely need to see pumped storage hydro coming online. These are big assets, they're big infrastructure assets. They need that support in terms of the cap and floor mechanism. But once they're on the system, they're good for many, many years, which is what we need. We need resilience, mm-hmm. and we need certainty, and we need to have confidence.
Okay. I can definitely see the argument of the... that there's like some market externality going on where, from a security of supply perspective, we're not building enough 20, 30, 40 hour systems, and we should be doing something to make sure we have that kind of that type of resilience on the system. At the shorter duration end, so the long duration storage piece starts at 6 hours in the current form. I'm not sure whether that will change. But do you see batteries, as you kind of mentioned, batteries globally have kind of gone beyond that 6 hour range. So do you see a world in which batteries are coming into that sort of 6 hour plus range and kind of working alongside pumped hydro? Or do you think that that is kind of not something that there should be like an exclusivity to kind of the cap and floor?
Yeah, I mean, excuse me. I think we'd like to, I mean, there's only a couple of our projects that are pump storage hydro that have a maximum storage capacity of 6 hours.
Okay.
So many of them are way more than that. But strategically, some of those projects that are 6 hours are in a position where we think actually we need them on the grid. And I think this is what will come out in the eligibility criteria for Ofgem, working with NESO and DESNZ, to look at, well, where do we need the storage and where is it going to have maximum impact in terms of reduced curtailment, grid operability. So I think there is a spatial factor to considering, not just the kind of this is 6 hours and therefore this is what we need it to do. But in terms of that longer, you know, medium duration energy storage that pumped storage hydro can do, I don't think batteries should be playing in that sphere really, because I don't think that's probably a good business model for them really. I mean, maybe they'll disagree, but you know, I think that they're an asset that will work very differently from pumped storage hydro.
Yeah.
And I think they've got there's going to be a massive boom. Obviously, costs have come down, but how we operate those batteries over the long term, nobody can really guarantee that they're going to want to do the same as pumped storage hydro in the future. So if they try and corner the market at the moment, it might be that in 5-10 years time they're behaving in a very different way.
Yeah.
Whereas pumped storage hydro, we know how it's going to operate.
Yeah.
Over the long term.
I think there's a couple of really good points. So around the system need, absolutely, that kind of like what kind of storage do we need where, and what kind of duration do we need? That's superb. I think we really, the kind of overall design of the system almost needs that kind of focus doubling down on. I'm not sure necessarily that I would agree on the medium duration, in that I think that there's a, from a cost to consumer perspective, I'm a fan of kind of an open market. So as you say, maybe storage might change its mind or might not want to do that business case. It's not up to the person designing the system. They should just say, right, what we need is 6 to 8 hours and go for it. And if say pumped hydro is a nice solution for that, then great, let's build that. If storage is a nice solution for that, great, go ahead and build that. If actually we shouldn't be building any storage and we should be building another interconnector, then maybe that's the right solution. But I think maybe system need and then open markets feels to me to be a good mix.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose if you look at a map where the pump storage hydro is likely to be, you know, we've got a big cluster around the Great Glen, for example. So if you look at the gigawatt hours of storage there, but then you think about the offshore wind, and then you think about the bootstrap that's going to come down to the southeast, for example, and also you think about how the interconnectors work across Europe and how we're going to be the Busbar of Europe. So I think a lot of storage that's going to be multiple gigawatt hours in terms of, you know, 200 gigawatt hours, 150 gigawatt hours, I think that's incredibly useful. And that's something that it's very unlikely that batteries are going to be located there doing that job. But at the end of the day, we need a lot of everything. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes hard to have this either or conversation, because in my mind, it's and.
Yeah, and that's where the system, your point around the system need is a really good one, which is to say, hey, look, we actually need 400 gigawatt hours of storage that looks something like 8 or 16 hours, whatever it is. Once you know what that number is, you can kind of then go and procure it. And as you say, similar for short duration, but if you had 2 6-hour batteries, but the number you actually need is 10, you can run them as 10-hour systems. You just run them at slightly lower power. So yeah. there's a way of kind of satisfying that need if you need to. What's next on the cap and floor? When do we hear the next step forward?
So at the moment, we've got Ofgem have created a new team, and they're going to be working with Desners on the cap and floor. And we've actually got a meeting with them tomorrow, so we know they're in place now. And Desners and Ofgem are going to be working on the eligibility criteria and the technical decision document. So basically the nitty gritty of what the cap and floor is going to look like. And yeah, hopefully as an industry, we'll be continuing to talk to them about what we need it to look like to make sure that we have that investor certainty and that these projects in the pipeline can mobilise within the timeframe that we need them to mobilise in. We're hoping that the application window will be open at the end of 2025 for the cap and floor. And that's certainly what our members are working towards at the moment. Mm-hmm. So we're saying to government that pace is everything, because actually this is a global supply chain, it's a global skill set, and it requires global capital. And we are in a bit of a global race in terms of pumped storage hydro around the world. There's a lot of eyes on how the UK's cap and floor is going to work at the moment. And, you know, we have to work really hard as UK PLC to make sure that supply chain is utilised in the projects in the UK rather than going to Canada or Australia. So, you know, I'm reminding government that it's not a fait accompli. You know, we've got to keep pushing this really hard to make sure that we can get everything we need in the UK to deliver that pipeline of projects.
Yeah. And when we saw something recently on Clean Power 2030 talking about some of the potential constraint costs we could see on the system, exactly to your point, if you have lots of generation in the north, but you can't necessarily get it down into the south, some of those constraint costs are really large, like 6 to 8 billion potentially per year in 2030, which from a cost to household perspective is like 200 to 300 pounds per household. So if you can do anything with, say, pumped hydro that kind of offers you a little bit of flexibility to, as sort of to some degree, a backup to what is going on within the transmission build out, then hey, surely that's a good place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the underpinning reason for the cap and floor was off the back of the LCP Delta report that said that in all scenarios, the cap and floor bringing forward long duration energy storage was a no regrets decision. It was going to save consumers money on their bill. What we've got to remember, though, is that actually it is a global supply chain and we don't want to overheat that supply chain and see cost escalation and cost inflation. Mm-hmm. So we have to think really hard about across, not just about pumped storage hydro, but across the whole net zero delivery, you know, in terms of transmission network, in terms of offshore wind, in terms of the skills that we need, you know, shortage of welders, you know, there's just a massive skills gap. And that all needs to be worked across the whole technology piece as well in this kind of push to get to decarbonize by 2030.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Agreed. And so you were mentioning some projects might be coming online sort of late 2020s, but the cap and floor is potentially not yet agreed. So are those projects, they're sort of taking the investment decision, but they're kind of bearing a lot of the risk in terms of bringing these projects through. Is that kind of where they are? And do we expect to see them coming online in sort of 26, 27? Is that when we see the first ones?
We won't see any commissioned until at least 2030.
Okay.
Coire Glas, which is the SSE project, they had committed, you know, 100 million to doing the access tunnel. And really that was to find out it was all about geological investigation to see what the ground's like. So they've done, you know, this 1.2 kilometer tunnel now that's 900 meters below the surface, but they still haven't reached their final investment decision. You know, that is still going to be deliberated through the cap and floor mechanism. They have to see what the investment case looks like with the cap and floor, with the detail of the cap and floor. So yeah, all these projects are being developed at risk at the moment, in the hope that, yeah, the cap and floor is going to be in place and that they're going to have an investable proposition and they can then go on and actually commission their projects. Mm. But yeah, no projects, I don't think, will be delivered before 2030. Mm-hmm. But 2030 is obviously the aspiration.
That's just such a useful kind of size of DevEx cost, like the 100 million, but it's actually pre-FID. And I think I've seen a picture of that access tunnel. It's enormous. Like, we're not talking about a small project here. This is like serious infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly. And we took some of the LDES team from Desnes up to see it because it's really impressive and you realise the scale and the enormity of these projects. And even if you go to see an existing pumped storage hydro, you know, their permanence is just impressive because they're huge and they're there and they're permanent. And that should give us a bit of reassurance, I think, as well, in terms of our grid resilience.
And also, like, extremely jealous because they are like the most beautiful like assets that you go and see. Like, if you go to like Dinorwig or look out on these reservoirs, they are like a fantastic holiday into some of the most beautiful parts of the country, right?
Yeah. And you know, they're often called kind of underground cathedrals because that's the size of these caverns as well. And they are real feats of engineering and they are mega projects. You know, these are £1 billion projects and they're massively impressive. And I think the key is that we haven't done it for a long time. This will be the largest scale rollout of large scale hydropower in over 50 years. And from a skill set point of view, it's really important that we're bringing through the engineers. And we've got a generation of engineers that are really kind of just at retirement or post-retirement. And we've got to train up our younger engineers on the back of their coattails, really, as these projects move forward. So it's a great skill set within the industry. And they're impressive projects.
Okay. I have two final questions for you. The first one is there anything you'd like to plug?
Well, we've not really talked about Tidal Range, so I think I should definitely plug Tidal Range. So we have 20 gigawatt potential as an island nation with the second highest tidal range in the world. And historically, Tidal Range has been dismissed because of a high levelized cost of energy.
Projects like Swansea Lagoon?
Yeah, there was Swansea Bay Tidal Lagoon, but there's other projects that are in development at the moment. So Mersey Tidal Barrage, for example, or West Somerset Lagoon. And these are 600 megawatts and 1.5 gigawatt projects making use of that high tidal range that we have. But I think the key is that decisions were made about Tidal Range stating the high levelized cost of energy in a very different world. And I think levelized cost of energy as a metric is too blunt an instrument to make these decisions on. It doesn't include kind of external costs, etc. It certainly doesn't consider variability of renewables or the grid infrastructure that's required to reinforce from, you know, offshore wind. So we are really stating the case to government and saying, actually, these aren't just energy generation projects, they're infrastructure projects that come with an entire supply chain requirement that needs an industrial strategy and the jobs and the skills that sit behind that. But also, it's all about UK grid resilience. And we are an island nation. And geopolitically wise, we should really be thinking how best we can reduce our fossil fuel consumption from a climate perspective, but also from a geopolitical perspective. And the key is that if we have timetabled energy generation from 20 gigawatts of tidal range across the country, which kind of acts like a base load, then that is something that we really need to be focused on bringing forward. And in terms of grid operability as well, you know, this is generation next to load. So if you think these projects are next to Liverpool, Cardiff, Swansea, it's not just next to load, it's next to increasing load. And that circumvents a lot of the issues we've got with the transmission upgrades that we're all waiting to see happen. So tidal range should be there in the mix. We have to say to government, levelized cost of energy is a metric. It's redundant. We need to think we need to think harder about the metrics that we're using in terms of grid security, grid resilience, and also just our energy sovereignty as well.
Okay. And I think sort of pound for pound on projects mentioned, tidal projects nearly always get a mention on, let's say we're into kind of the YouTube comment section, we will 100% have many fans of kind of tidal coming out to say, finally, we've kind of covered it.
Yes.
So yeah, a very good plug. And then what is your contrarian view? So what is one thing that you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
Well, I always talk a lot about local energy solutions. I think there's been so much focus on big, you know, big solar, big wind, everything's transmission connected. And what I always say is we can't decarbonize unless we're looking at the distribution network, which is where we're going to have to electrify heat and transport, and where we're going to have to persuade people to electrify heat and transport. So I think it's hugely overlooked. I talk about hydropower, which in most cases is connected at the distribution network. And I talk about the fact that we need new generation to meet the new smart, flexible load of electrification, heat and transport in a whole system community approach. And until we really understand what that looks like and how important it is, it's all just top down. And we're not going to bring people along with us. You know, I also think that to most people, decarbonising the grid by 2030 is irrelevant. You know, what people want is affordable energy and healthy, warm homes. And that again goes back to local energy solutions. So from my perspective, we have to do much more work at the local community level to actually show people the vision of what decarbonisation looks like in terms of real and tangible benefits for consumers and for householders within communities, for them to really get buy-in. And we don't get buy-in, we're not going to be able to do this.
Oh, I 100% agree. If we don't put pounds back into people's pockets and they don't feel the benefit of the transition, we are going to be in a real sticky situation come 2030. So yeah, wholeheartedly agree. Maybe that's not the point of a contrarian question, but I agree with you. Okay, perfect, brilliant. Well, Kate, thank you very much for coming on Transmission. You've been a fantastic guest, and we'll have you back anytime.
Thank you, Ed. It's been really enjoyable. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Transmission, a Modo Energy podcast. Transmission delivers conversations from industry leaders and experts exploring energy markets and the operations and technologies related to grid-scale battery energy storage. Check out our other episodes by searching Transmission wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the Energy Academy, our video crash course on how markets in Great Britain and ERCOT work, or head to modoenergy.com to see our written research. Thanks for listening.